Welcome to The Human Way. I'm your host, Matt Havens. This is a podcast focused on people doing good by focusing on the similarity that we all share instead of what pulls us apart. At the end of the day, we're all human. So let's dive in. Hey, y'all. Welcome to the first ever episode of The Human Way with Matt Havens. Thank you for tuning in. You're awesome. Love you all for doing so. Look, I'm also a realist, though, okay? If you're listening to this, you're probably a friend. You're a friend or a close acquaintance. So thank you. I love you for being one of those. And if you're not, if you just stumbled upon this or this is the first time we've interacted, you're also awesome. You're probably even better than the other people because you are listening to somebody's first attempt at a podcast. So you have got to be a pretty cool person. Let's be friends. I love you already. But yeah, this is something I've been wanting to do for a couple of years. 2021 felt like the year to get off my butt and do it. But let me explain a little bit about what I want to accomplish with this podcast, with these conversations. I think it is time for us to recognize the human side of life, of work, of just our existence. And unfortunately, something that's been happening for the last couple of years is we're focusing more and more on the differences that push us apart. You're seeing that in social media, with technology. You're seeing it in media. And we're starting to see that. It's creeping into everyday life where we keep focusing on the things that divide us, the things that make us different from each other. We're putting people into boxes. And for years, I've been trying to help push forward this conversation that we're a lot more similar to each other than we give ourselves credit for. And so I want to use this podcast as a way to bring those stories to life, focus on the similarities we have, what we can learn from those experiences. And at the end of the day, if we recognize that we're all human, we're all going through the same stuff, we might just experience those things a little bit differently, then I think we can move together and towards success, towards happiness, towards just general goodness. So that's what we're going to do. This podcast, we're going to interview business leaders, community leaders, just good people doing good things. And, you know, I want to show that despite those differences that we might have, and yes, there are some differences that people might have, then they were all human. And so now with that said about those differences, if you're looking for a podcast that is going to interview extremely successful people, if you're Elon Musk's of the world and people who have started businesses from the ground up, you might get some of that here. But for the most part, I don't want to focus on individual successes. And what I mean by that is there's a ton of stuff out there today where we can learn from successful people, happy people, wealthy people, whatever it is. And we'll learn about some of those individual traits that they might have and that hopefully traits that we also have ourselves too, right? Drive, ambition, tenacity, vision. And we can all learn about those individual traits, but I don't want to focus on the individual successes. I want to focus on these larger groups, these things that if we understand about ourselves, about each other, we can move large groups of people towards something. And so over the course of time, I hope that will kind of come to light. It sounds a little ambiguous as we talk about it now, but that's what we're going to focus on. So, you know, for example, some of the things that I think as humans, we all experience is like we all experience failure. So I want to interview and talk with people who have experienced failure, how we learn to embrace that a little bit more. I want to talk to people about finding pure purpose in life. Every single one of us is looking for some form of purpose. And so how can we learn from others who found theirs? How can we find our own? And also another thing that I know we'll probably get into is this weird relationship we have with time. As people, we don't maybe recognize it, but you know, you've heard the phrase, the days are long, but the years are short. That's because as humans, we are constantly in this battle with time, whether or not we recognize it or not. So how do we live for today and plan for tomorrow? You know, we'll get into some of those conversations. And a big one that we're going to start about by talking here today is that as people, every single one of us, regardless of where you come from, your walk of life, every single one of us is looking for community and how important community is in work, in life, to finding it and to finding the right one. So we'll get into that in here a little bit. Just a little bit about me in case, like I said, you're this random person who found this podcast. I am a Midwest boy at heart that's living in Texas. My day job, I'm a keynote speaker, leadership coach. I am Megan's husband and a father to twin daughters who are in first grade, Avery and Emerson. Those last two, I'm that all the time. And I'm sort of a goof, a little bit goofy, kind of like a silent, sarcastic goofy in a way. So you might get a little bit of that throughout this. But before I was a keynote speaker and leadership coach, you know, I kind of had the normal corporate job. 13 years with a Fortune 50 company. 6 or 7 of those years, I was a leader in the contact center environment, so call center. We'll actually talk about that here a little bit today. But you know, in that corporate career, I was really very interested in the boxes that we put people in at work. My career started off really talking about the millennials and baby boomers and how we work together better. I spent maybe 3 years trying to help an organization on that issue. And then once I kind of progressed into a management role, I realized that it's just a different box we're putting people into. We put people in a management box. We put people in, I don't know, an employee or associate box. Or if you have a full-time and part-time workforce, then you might even separate those boxes. And I always just found that interesting. Like, why do we do that? Is it just because it's easier that we put people into these boxes? I don't know. So after kind of like going through that experience, I started speaking. I started getting out on stages in large conferences and groups talking about how we can stop putting people into these boxes and start looking at each other as people. And if we understand maybe why somebody is the way that they are, then we have a lot more empathy and understanding towards that person and we can work together better. So that's kind of what I've been doing, what I've been up to. And that's why I know that this idea of community is so important. And every single one of us, regardless of our age, we're searching for a community to be a part of. But it's important to point out that this is not just my opinion. It's a fact. It's a fact. It's proven over centuries worth of data by a concept that I like to call the 100 human principle. And what this is based off of research that was done in the early 2000s by a British and English philosopher named Robin Dunbar. And what Dunbar was trying to do is he was trying to figure out how many people any one person could care about at a given moment. So I like to think of it as how many people can you put in your brain at once? You know, if each person, each relationship takes up a little bit of space in your brain, you know, think of it like a computer. Well, eventually you're going to run out of storage. And at what point does that happen? And what Dunbar found is that it's actually around 150 people that you run out of storage. That's about the number of people that we can care about at a given moment. Now, I've had to clarify this in the past, and I'm going to do it here. We have to be careful about that word care, because I believe that regardless of whether or not you have a physical relationship with somebody, an emotional relationship with somebody, you should care about them. I don't know everybody in this world. I don't know everybody. I don't even know everybody that lives on my street. But I should care about them. I should want to see them happy. I should want to see them successful. So there is no limit to the number of people that we can care about. But in Dunbar's research and this idea of the 100 human principle, we do have to recognize that when we're talking about strong emotional connections, these strong relationships, the types of people that you might invite to a happy hour or to a birthday party, there is actually a limit. And that limit is about 150 people. Now, like I said, this isn't my opinion. It's fact because it's proven over centuries worth of data. We know that an 18th century English parsonage was 150 people big. We know that Neolithic farming villages were about 150 people big. We know that the Roman military companies were 150 people big, and an American military company is about 160. And, you know, I'd argue that if you've ever been to a large wedding, it probably didn't exceed 300 people. Well, that's 150 people for each marrying side of that agreement. And Facebook has done this study. They've done a ton of studying lately, but they did a study that said it doesn't matter how many people you have in your friend network. And I challenge you to pull up your social media, look at the followers you have on Instagram, look at the number of friends that you're with on Facebook or number of people that you've connected with on LinkedIn. And some of you are going to have thousands of people on that. But what Facebook found is that it doesn't matter how many friends you have in that network. You only interact with 150 of them. And the reason for that, it's why they've actually changed their algorithm. They adjusted it to say, hey, you don't need to see all 1,000 people. We just show you who we think is part of your community. If you don't trust me, if you don't believe me on that, then I always encourage people, go out, think of somebody who you haven't seen their posts in a while. Honest truth is they've probably been posting. It just didn't show up on your feed. So go and look around on their page for a little bit, and you'll be surprised when next day you go back and all of a sudden they're showing up again. Because Facebook, the algorithms, it thinks that those people are back in your 150. And so this concept, this idea that every single one of us, regardless of our age, regardless of where we come from, we're all out in search for about 150 people to connect to. I think it's smaller than that. I think it's 100. I also like 100 because it's a round number. It's easier to remember. But if I challenge you right now to write down the number of people that are in your social network, the number of people that take up mental real estate in your brain, I guarantee most of you couldn't even get to 100. You would get through 20 real quick. You'd start to slow down at about 50. And by the time, if you even got to 100, you'd really be pulling hard to see like, oh yeah, these people are really truly part of my community. And so I use that illustration oftentimes, like from stage, in conversations with people, to recognize that our world's a lot smaller than we think. And we think it's this huge thing because of the internet, because of technology, because it looks like all of a sudden now with information and technology today, it feels like our community is 7 billion people large. But the reality is we're really only stuck in about this 150 people who make up our space. And that's why I think it's super important that we find the right community to be a part of. I think it's also important to recognize that sometimes there's people in our communities today that don't deserve to be there. They don't deserve to take up the mental real estate in our brain for a variety of reasons. It could be a million different reasons, but we have to recognize that as well too. And so it's if we understand this concept, I guarantee you, your social relationships will be better. I think your life will be better. In some cases, our mental health will be better if we recognize that our world's a lot smaller than maybe we're being led to believe in our own heads, as well as what we maybe see outside. It's gonna make us better parents. It's gonna make us better leaders. And so, you know, my goal again with this podcast is to kind of interview people and help us realize that, build community, because it's super important for all of us to have that sense of purpose and community in life. But since I don't have somebody here to interview right now, I wanted to share a clip of an interview that I heard recently. It was from about a year ago, and credit here to Bootleg Kevin and DJ Head. Now, one of the things y'all may not know about me is that I'm definitely hardcore rap, R&B, hip hop music listener. Okay, don't get it wrong, folks. Yeah, I grew up in the mean streets of Bloomington, Illinois, but it's just always been a part of my life. Seventh grade, my brother and I both bought each other the DMX CD for Christmas. I had a Tupac poster up in my room when I grew up. I think it was also next to the Britney Spears one, which is really sad that I had a Britney Spears poster in my room, but I did. And Tupac and Britney Spears, I don't know that they would have been like in the same social circle, but whatever. But I heard this interview, and it was with the artist T-Pain. Now, if you don't know who T-Pain is, you should know who T-Pain is. But if you don't, two-time Grammy Award-winning artist, master of the auto-tune, maybe rivals Teddy Riley in that regard, but an amazing musical talent. And he was doing this interview talking about when he signed his first contract with a record label. And he signed with Akon. Akon is another artist, had a record label, And he signed with Akon over going, instead of going with one of the large record labels at the time, Interscope Records, who was offering him a completely different option. And I think we can learn from why T-Pain decided to sign with Akon instead. So let me play this here for you. And then I'll come back with some questions that we can think about.
Involved, like Akon was signed to Interscope Records,
right?
And Interscope Records offered me a $900,000 signing bonus,
which is crazy.
As a 18-year-old,
what?
That sounds crazy.
Out of Tallahassee,
and at this very moment, there's no lights on in your house. You can't like at this very moment, my studio's been run off a generator outside, and wow. We can't run it past 11 o'clock because that's when the law says the noise ordinance kicks in and all this stuff. So we have to read up a lot. But at this very moment, I have no power in my house. We can't pay for gas to get to the airport to fly to Interscope Records. They're offering us these things. And, you know, we went to Atlantic, which was offering $700,000. But everybody was offering all these things for the single.
Wow.
Just for the one record.
Just for the one record. I went to Akon, and Akon said, bro, I got 20 grand and a career. I can guarantee, I'll give you 20 grand. I know that's not a lot of money, but I guarantee you're going to have a career and not just a song.
And that's
and at that time, Akon wasn't seen as a mogul. Right. So you really took a gamble.
Absolutely. That's a big gamble. The way he was talking, it was like, you know, when I went to all these companies, they was like, I love this song. What can we do? Can we get another song? Can we do this song? And Akon was like, I love you. I love what you're doing, and I want to make sure you have a long career.
Wow.
And he was the only person talking like that. And I wasn't in it for short money. I was trying to get the long play going, so he was the only one talking about it, so I went with him.
That's crazy.
You know what I'm saying? And I literally...
Yo, I mean, for real, how... Like, what would you do in that situation? You are struggling. You're a new artist. You don't even have power on at the house, and somebody offers you $900,000 or 20. What would you do in that situation? I mean, I know what I would do. I'd take the 900. I would have chosen a different path, and that's okay. I would have like probably spent like $100,000 of that. Doing something stupid probably. But then I would have like invested the $800,000 and I probably could have lived off of that and been pretty happy. But here's the thing is I absolutely understand why he took the $20,000. I understand this idea of you are going to a record label, you're going to somebody, you're selling your product, your services, and that's all that they're focused on. They're focused on what you can bring to them. They're focused on not who you are as a person. And then this other side is focusing on you, saying, I want you to be a part of something. I believe in you. And how much more powerful that is. But I think we gotta ask ourselves, like, what would we do if put in a similar situation? The immediate gratification of something that is right there in front of us that maybe in some cases could be life-changing, or this idea of finding community. I think T-Pain in that situation, he found his community. Now, if you followed along with the story, you know that like there's record label disputes post that. We're not getting into that here. That's for somebody else to do. But I think T-Pain found his community in that regard. And he made the decision to go with $20,000 and the promise of something bigger because somebody believed in him and treated him like a person. And so when organizations, when leaders, when people, when we start treating other people as a number, or we start, again, putting them into this box, when we think of people as a means to an end, everything in that relationship is immediately now severed and gone. Your impact, your influence is gone. Because you've stopped treating somebody like a human, and instead you've treated them now like a number or something else. And I guarantee that's what happened with Interscope in that situation, is they saw T-Pain as another artist. There's a million of them out there. He's a number. We ain't going to worry about that. And you could obviously argue that that's a mistake because he went on to have a successful career without Interscope in that regard. And so if you're listening to this and you're a leader, or you're thinking about, well, how can I sort of apply this in our life? I think the question we have to start asking is, how are we building that same sense of community in our life? How are we giving people a voice to be themselves? And I'll tell you really quickly, just a story here from my past that kind of related to this is, you know, I mentioned I was a leader in contact centers. And, you know, if you think of a contact center, if you think of a call center, there are certainly some stereotypes that immediately, you know, happen. Me saying I worked in a contact center, you know, you think Cube Farm, you think headsets on, just answering call after call after call after call. And the reason that there's a stereotype is because there's absolutely some truth to that. But we had a situation that related to a tour bid and a shift bid that I think kind of plays into this idea of community. So because most of you probably don't know about tour bids or shift bids, what that is, you know, if you're going to run a call center and have people calling in to you, you need to make sure you have a staff that is there to answer those calls. And so typically most organizations will do a tour bid or a shift bid to say, hey, as an employee who is answering those phones, I'm going to bid or say that I want to work this time period so that I'm available to answer those calls. And those one, that period of time works for me. That works for me in my life. But then occasionally as calls fluctuate or demand changes, which happens frequently and seasonally and sometimes daily, organizations are going to have to adjust the schedules of people who are working there to make sure that they're there to answer the calls for their customers. And so it's very common in contact centers to do these tour bids. Hopefully you don't have to do them a lot, but you're going to have to adjust your workforce to make sure that people are there for your customers. So we had a situation in the contact center that I was leading where we were pretty out of whack. Like we were way off base with where our people were working and when, and then the calls that were coming in. So we needed to do a tour bid. We probably needed to do one for a couple of months. And so we worked with, you know, various people, and we come up with this plan of how we were going to have to adjust people. And it was pretty significant. You know, I think I'm making this number up now because it's been some years, but let's say 80% of the workforce was going to have to adjust their schedule. And that's a big thing to do to somebody, to say, hey, I don't know, you're working right now from 2 p.m. to 10 p.m. And starting next week or next month, I need you to flip that completely and work from 6 a.m. to 2 p.m. I mean, people got lives. You got family to take care of. You got kids to drop off of school, whatever it may be. You got things to do. And you've planned around this. And now here we are as an organization or as a leader coming in and saying, nope, need you to switch up and do something different for us. And so typically what would happen is we would just announce the tour bid. Here are the shifts. You as an employee, you would kind of rank it, say, I want to work 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, whatever. And then based on some statistics and things like that, you would get placed. That's how most tour bids work. But what I wanted to try in that situation was, since we were adjusting so many people, I wanted to see if there's a way that we could do it that didn't impact our people as much. Like, what if, instead of telling them when they had to work, what if we showed them when people are calling us and we asked them to not pick one of our schedules, but to make up their own? Make up your own schedule, come into work. You know when people are calling, so of course we have to be here for our customer, but you know, you tell us what works best for you in your situation. And I approached this. Luckily, I had some great leadership at the time. It was like, yeah, let's try this. But it was certainly the first time this had ever been done. And so certainly some people who were skeptical about whether or not it would work. But so that's what we did. Went to our employees and said, hey, I think we ran through a presentation and said, hey, here's when people are calling. Here's kind of a rough estimate of what we know we're probably going to need from a staffing perspective. But we want you to make your own schedule, as long as it follows some very basic parameters, things like you had to work 40 hours or, you know, you couldn't work every day. You had to have a day off. As long as it fits these basic parameters, we will grant it. And I think we committed at that time, we will grant it for 2 months for sure. And then from there, we'll reassess. One amazing thing happened. When given that option, when able to see the same information that we had in leadership, this group of associates went back. They looked at the numbers themselves and they said, well, I can tell we got to be here for our customers, right? And they created schedules that worked for them, things that were good for their personal life, that would, in some cases, you know, we had people that said, well, I want to work a little bit here, and then I just want to be home when my kids get off the school bus. And so I'd like to go home for a little while, and then I'm going to come back. After they go to bed, I'm going to come back and work for a little bit. They did some things that we would have never forced somebody into, but they came up with schedules that better met us and our needs as an organization and meant something to them. And so we did that. They came back. We granted people their wishes. And as the day we turned it on, we turned on the switch with these new schedules and calls coming in. That day we exceeded every single metric, every single result that we were looking to get. We exceeded it by a mile. And I can't speak for everybody who was there, but the conversations I had with a lot of people was how different this felt. This felt like we had a voice. We had a say in what was going to happen so that we could meet our customers' needs, but we could also do what we need to do in life. And it was a great feeling. Those results kept up for quite some time. And then, you know, we were able to do something that gave people a voice. But the reason we did it, and this is important, the reason we did this is because the people that we worked together with, it didn't matter if you were management, full-time, part-time, whatever your tenure with the organization, we were a community. We were a fairly small team at that time, and we were a community. And when you treat people in your community the way that you'd want to be treated, amazing things happen. But if we, I don't think if we had built that community enough, then I'm not necessarily sure it would have worked. If we hadn't built that community to start, then I think in some cases it would have said, well, I don't really care when people are calling. I'm just going to do what's good for me. But we had such a balance because I think we focused on building a community and being a part of something. And the people who then were creating these schedules, they were able to kind of come in and say, hey, this is my community. I want to be there. And we can do both. And so that's an example, I think, of just how powerful community can be. But the key is we have to find our own. We have to find, where is our community? Is it the right one? Is it the right one for us? And is it one that supports us in a two-way reciprocity? So if you stuck around long enough to listen to these stories, then what I would encourage you to do is, wherever you are, if you can, take out a pen, take out your notes app on your phone, or do it later if you need to. But we need to figure out where our community is for ourselves. And we do that first by recognizing what we have today. So start off by writing out the first 50 people, the first 50 people who take up mental real estate in your brain. You'll probably start with family first, then you'll go to close friends, maybe some work acquaintances, but try to get to 50. If you get to 50, then I'll push you to 100. But try to take stock in your community as it is today. And after you've done that, then go back and look at that list. Ask yourself some questions about, you know, who were some of the first people that easily jumped off the brain and onto the page. Look at how you've grouped things. Do you group it in categories like work friends or neighbors and family and so on and so forth? I think there's some insight there. But also, who are the people who aren't on that list anymore? That if you had done this exercise 5 years ago, they would have been on it. But they're not there anymore for a variety of reasons. And is that good or is that bad? There's things to learn there. But that about does it. We're going to kind of wrap up here a little bit. That's for the first episode. I hope you've enjoyed this idea. You know, gave you a little bit of an exercise maybe to try that might help you in that regard. And if this has been something that you want to continue and hear more of, then please comment. like it, share it, do whatever you need to do in that space. I would love to get this out to more and more people. And if you know somebody who needs to come on and have a conversation, if they're good people doing good things, then I want to talk to them. So let me know. But do all those things, like, share, subscribe. I'm a millennial, right? We need that constant gratification in our life. So please do that. But hey, just remember at the end of this, at the end of the day, you're not alone. We're all human together. We are in this together. So let's go get it.